Hello, everyone. Welcome to the bonus episode. And Dominic, you are back from Ireland. You've made it back.
Oh, yeah. Well remembered, Tom.
Well, what do you mean well remembered? I had to interrupt my holiday to do it. Of course I remember it.
Did you? I thought Tony was going to do it with Theo.
No, I did it.
You spared them. So, caught up in the air traffic control meltdown. Big meltdown, which actually turns out was the fault of a French airline, apparently, Tom. Did you see this? They put their details wrongly or something.
So it's said.
Almost certainly true.
But don't you think that if it all it takes is a French airline to feed its details in wrongly?
Terrifying.
That doesn't say much about the software.
Well, no, it doesn't.
Anyway, we're saloon barring.
Yeah.
We are both very much back to school, aren't we? I'm back from my holiday.
Yeah.
You've been back from your holidays for a few weeks. And of course, this is the time, I don't know whether it's true in other countries, but in Britain, people are going back to school.
Yep, they are.
And fittingly, we have just recorded two episodes on the real Harry Potter and the real Hogwarts.
We have indeed.
So looking at the roots of Harry Potter in the boarding school stories that begin with Tom Brown's school days, and then going even further back to find out whether it was really possible that Hogwarts had been founded in the 9th century in Scotland.
Yes.
And you were very skeptical, weren't you?
I am skeptical. I don't believe Hogwarts was founded then, Tom. I think Hogwarts is probably a 19th century foundation with an invented earlier history. I don't believe they needed a castle, because I don't think they'd have known what a castle was in the 10th century. Do you?
So this is the kind of searching, skeptical analysis that Dominic always brings to the field of historical inquiry. So very much something to look forward to.
Harry Potter is on constantly in my household, the audiobooks, because Arthur just likes them as a kind of soundtrack. So he'll be doing other stuff and he'll have friends around and they'll be doing stuff, but just Stephen Fry is speaking constantly in the background. So Stephen Fry is very much a presence in our house. It's like the Troy episode all over again, Tom.
Is his impression of Professor McGonagall as good as mine?
Well, Tom does an absolutely extraordinary Scottish accent in these episodes. Actually, talking of your various performances, I had forgotten your singing in the 60s fashion episodes.
Have you heard it?
I haven't. I was quite traumatised, to be honest with you.
I thought it was quite good. Somebody compared me to Rex Harrison, which I thought was, I don't mind that.
Wow. Rex Harrison was widely regarded as a terrible man, Tom.
Was he?
If you go online and look up sort of Rex Harrison anecdotes, he was regarded as one of the most arrogant and unpleasant men in Hollywood.
Well, how fitting.
Yeah. So, talking of arrogant and unpleasant men, we have just released the Marquis de Sade episode, which actually is less, everyone thinks, oh, golly, that'll be pure filth. But no.
No, it's all about philosophy, isn't it?
It was all about philosophy.
The French Revolution.
There was a little bit of handcuffs, but it was mainly philosophy.
Yes. Butt plugs made of wax were also featured, as I remember, you don't normally get on. Certainly the rest is politics.
No, you don't. Well, or do you? Who knows? You'll be interviewing Rory Stewart this evening, won't you? So you can find out.
Yeah.
And then on Thursday, we have The Architect of Modern China. So that's about Deng Xiaoping. And that is with Rana Mitter talking to us about China since Mao, basically. But it's really about Deng in the 1980s.
Yeah, very interesting subject.
So we are always keen to answer people's questions. However, believe it or not, we're in danger of running out. Extraordinary scenes. So people, please go on to the Discord. Go into the chat community. Two words that Tom loves to hear repeated. Go into the chat community and post your questions in the bonus thread. And Tom, I know, will be delighted to answer them, won't you, Tom?
Although, Dominic, we should add the caveat that next week we will probably not be doing questions because Dominic was so frustrated at not being able to talk about everything that he knows about boarding school stories in the episodes that we've just recorded, that we are going to do something on that, aren't we, in the bonus episode.
I just have more to say. I have so much to say, Tom.
I know you do. So just for next week, but please keep firing them in and we'll carry them on. Right. So Dominic, here is a question for you from Reticus. Where do you think the US-China policy went wrong? Was it from the beginning with Nixon, Bush number one, and Clinton blowing off Tiananmen Square, just expecting China to line up with the neoliberal New World Order? Bush two, ignoring rising tension and regression to focus on Islamic terrorism. Obama not doing much of anything when China's aggressive direction and hegemonic ambitions became overt. Some matrix of all of these. So there's a lot
God
of
Almighty.
Questions there. Yeah.
Tom.
And not even mentioning Trump or Biden.
I thought you'd start me off gently.
No.
But
straight
no.
Straight in at the deep end.
Straight in at the deep end. So there's a lot of... I suppose I would question the premise of that. Of the question.
That's a scholarship boy for you. Attacking the premise of the question.
I would.
God, we've got to start thinking about schools.
I would. Ah. I would question. Yes, sir. I would question the premise because...
Very good.
I think the idea that it went wrong obviously implies that there's some alternative path in which it could have, as it were, gone right and been fixed. And isn't the argument put forward by some writers, I think Graham Allison at Harvard is one of them, the idea of the Thucydidean trap,
yes,
that you have a rising power and a falling power. I mean, the argument there is that there's a kind of structural inevitability to China-US tensions. I mean, it's a little bit like Britain and Germany before the First World War, say. The idea that there's some neat little, there's some neat fix, there's some administration policy that could be followed that would have sorted it out. What is it? A preemptive strike? I mean, that's obviously never going to happen. Is it from the beginning with Nixon, says Reticus? Well, I mean, Nixon's policy of bringing China in from the cold, as it were, is generally regarded as a sensible policy, bringing China back into the kind of the world system. Bush and Clinton ignoring Tiananmen Square. I mean, what are they going to do afterwards? I mean, punish China, isolate China again? Bush, too, ignoring rising tension to focus on Islamic terrorism, neocon nation building. Okay, I agree with you, by the way, and I say this as somebody who recently went to the George W. Bush Library and Museum in Dallas, Texas.
Did it have his paintings?
Yes, it did have his paintings.
Were they good?
Sure, there's a bit of a disagreement in my household about it. I think they're quite bad, and Catherine thinks they have been unjustly maligned.
Right. I wouldn't have Catherine down as a fan of George W. Bush.
No, she's not, but she thinks an artist, he is. Because she said to me, you couldn't do anything remotely as good as George Bush's paintings, which is true.
But that's not necessarily saying that he's good, is it? It's just saying that you're terrible.
But for an amateur who spent a lot of time as, you know, chief executive and commander-in-chief of the United States.
Yeah, but he's been doing it since then, hasn't he?
He has, but
so here's the question. Is it better than Churchill's?
No, Churchill's a better painter.
Is it better than Hitler's?
Well, I knew you were going to go there. Is it better than Hitler's? See, our critics have reviewed Churchill's and Hitler's paintings, and they've said of Hitler, oh, his paintings are terrible. These are the product of a diseased mind, blah, 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 blah. I don't think that's true. I think his painted postcards of scenes from Vienna,
they're all right.
They are not terrible, and they're clearly far better than anything you or I could do. I mean, Hitler was not utterly untalented as an artist, surely.
Controversial opinions.
Because he wouldn't have been able to... I mean, the very fact that he entered...
Yeah, but Dominic, he's evil, so he can't be good at painting.
Well, I think a lot of artists are terrible people, Tom. So it doesn't surprise me in the slightest.
Do you? Do you think that?
Reticus, to go back to Reticus's question, I don't think there ever was a fix. I think the United States, the policy with China... It's just a really, it's a pretty boring and predictable answer, cliched answer, but it's a really hard balancing act to kind of attempt to deter the Chinese from overt aggression, while at the same time trying to bind them into a kind of liberal system.
It's often expressed in terms of China reclaiming the place that it held in the 18th century.
Yeah.
And it casts the period of Western supremacy as a mere blip, and that India and China, these great civilizational powers, have always been of an outsized influence relative to other places in the world. Do you think that there's truth to that?
The Chinese certainly have a sense that they're reclaiming their place in the sun, don't they? I think most scholars or China watchers for more than half a century have accepted that the resurgence of China is inevitable, but that probably means some kind of competition for control of the Pacific. I think American interests in the Pacific obviously lay behind the war with Japan. I actually can't remember what your question was, Tom, so I'm just whittering.
I was just wondering whether the idea that Western power was inevitably bound to recede, that the natural geopolitical order of things is that China and India are the preponderant powers.
I think that's exaggerated. The United States is still the most powerful nation in the world, I would say. It will never again recapture the extraordinary preeminence that it had in the 1990s.
One of the interesting things, we're talking about Rana Mehta coming and talking about Deng Xiaoping and the emergence of China from Maoism. But one of the things that has happened over the summer since we actually recorded that episode is a sense, reading the newspapers, that China is in a good deal more trouble economically.
Yes, economically, yeah.
Than was the case even 2 or 3 months ago.
I think that's always been the question in my mind about China. The economic growth, breakneck economic growth at an extraordinary level, not only does it not last forever, but secondly, it causes problems of its own. It causes all kinds of social tensions, economic growth just as much as economic recession does, but also it creates an expectation of permanent economic growth that when that's not met can cause great political and social tensions. And actually, it's implausible for people to believe that for the rest of this century, you know, the rule of the Chinese Communist Party will be unchallenged by competitors and there'll be no uprisings. I mean, that's never happened in any country. So what will be really interesting is to see how the regime copes with all that and how, you know, if there is an economic downturn in China, how will these newly embourgeoised kind of middle classes, how will they cope with the disappointments or their living standards stagnating or even conceivably one day falling? And how would an authoritarian system cope with that? Because often authoritarian systems cope very badly. So that's as possible, I think. In fact, probably more likely, I would reckon, than a military confrontation between China and the United States. All the war games and things like that that I've read, I once spent a day going down a mad rabbit hole and reading kind of war games.
About America and China?
About a war over Taiwan. They envisage a colossal conflict. Maybe not a nuclear conflict, but like the loss of, you know, both sides would lose, suffer massive naval losses and losses of men and all this kind of thing.
And who would win?
I think it would be actually very difficult. If the Americans, you know, really got stuck in, for the Chinese to conquer Taiwan, to make amphibious landings, defeat the Taiwanese, seize their cities, that's hard going.
So be like Kublai Khan, failing to conquer Japan.
Yeah, I mean, it could be like that, Tom.
The rest is the future.
We should do the rest is futurology.
That'd be quite fun, wouldn't it?
Yeah. Well, now that, I mean, I've got a whole load of crystal ball pieces from Her Majesty's favourite newspaper.
The Times.
Her Majesty's, Tom.
Oh, of course, yes.
I've got a load of crystal ball. So I was looking through, now that I have been transferred, I was looking through some of my favourites. My favourite one, I've forgotten that I predicted in 2013 that Nicolas Sarkozy would invade Britain in 2018.
Did you?
I did.
Well, I think the only futurology that you've engaged on in The Rest is History is you poo-pooing my notion that Rishi Sunak would become Prime Minister. So I'm just reminding everyone of who was right about that. Right, should we have another question?
Well, he's Prime Minister in name only, isn't he, Tom? Let's be honest.
Still, yeah, well. So here's Graham Anderson.
Yeah.
What are history's most significant unintended consequences, e.g. Napoleonic France stimulating pan-Germanism with disastrous results for France a century later?
Oh, my word.
I imagine, again, you'd attack the basis of that question, would you?
No, I wouldn't.
Okay. Because I would say that demography is destiny, that France was always going to be overshadowed because the French stopped having children relative to Germany and Britain.
But Germany was not inevitably going to be united, was it?
But France was always going to be eclipsed simply because, for reasons that are fascinating to debate,
yeah,
they stopped having children in the 18th century. I mean, I read some amazing statistic that in the 18th century, 1 in 20 people on the face of the earth were French. It was the China of Europe.
I read an article this weekend about France as the China of Europe.
Yes.
We've clearly been reading the same things, Tom. Must be true. I like the premise of that question. I think Germany could have stayed disunited. Napoleon and the stimulation that he gave to German nationalism. Yeah, I like that. So I'm trying to think of other unanticipated consequences. Golly.
So I'll give one.
Go on.
The Roman employment of Arab mercenaries on their frontiers in late antiquity.
Oh, very good. Very good. Yeah.
So both the Persians and the Romans do this.
Are they called the Lachmids?
The Lachmids and the Gassanids.
Yes, yeah.
And they are employed by both the great superpowers who are facing each other off in the Near East. So the Roman Empire and the Persian Empire, the Sasanian Empire, which we must do an episode on. Or indeed several. Mm. And they employ Arab tribesmen who become familiar with the civilizations of the settled civilizations of the Fertile Crescent. They start to cohere as states. They become familiar with Zoroastrianism and Jewish and Christian traditions. They become seasoned in the practice of arms under both the imperial powers. And the long-term consequences of this for the emergence of Islam are seismic. So I offer that.
I love that. That's a good one. My favorite, most recent one, which is a silly one, is there was a guy who was the MP for Falkirk called Eric Joyce.
Oh, yes, yes, yes. Very
who,
good.
Who headbutted somebody in the bar of the House of Commons or was accused of headbutting or fighting them in some way, getting drunk and fighting them. He ended up being deselected. So this is the beginning of the 2010s. A lot of our British sisters will know what's coming, but our overseas ones probably won't. So he wasn't a real name to conjure with. He was got rid of. He had to go. Maybe he wasn't deselected or resigned. I can't remember. He had to go. They had to have a new selection in Falkirk for a new Labour MP. This was very controversial because the trade unions were accused of fixing it for their own candidate. And in reaction to this, amid a storm of press criticism, Ed Miliband changed the rules of the Labour Party. Now, little did he know that within just a couple of years, he would be gone as Labour leader. And under the new rules, the Labour members elected Jeremy Corbyn as leader. And Jeremy Corbyn, almost uniquely among people who might have become Labour leader, very, very lukewarm indeed, I think it's fair to say, downright sceptical about British membership of the EU. So Jeremy Corbyn did not campaign very enthusiastically for Britain to remain in the Brexit referendum. Britain ended up leaving by a narrow margin. And Tom, as they say, the rest is history. And so had Eric Joyce not had one drink too many.
Yeah, that's a very good one.
Then Britain might still be in the EU. Who knows?
But do you believe that? I mean, that's often said, but...
No, I don't actually.
No.
No, but I think it's fun.
Okay, so another one that we have talked about this summer, I would guess would be Britain's victory in the Seven Years' War for the emergence of the United States.
Oh, that's a very good one. Yes, that might, the United States might not have emerged had the French still been there.
Yeah. Okay, so should we have another question? I think Theo's about to nag.
So one for you, Tom. Caput Nili. Had Aurelian lived longer and had more time to push his monotheistic sun cult, what would have been the impact on the rise of Christianity? Does Aurelian's embrace of monotheism hurt or help the Christian cause?
Okay, there's quite a lot to unpick there.
Yeah, it's always the way with these questions.
Aurelian is a very successful emperor in the 3rd century AD, which I'm sure people remember is a terrible time for the Roman Empire. It's kind of disintegrating, coming apart at the seams, emperors fighting each other left, right, and center. And what had happened was that there'd been a disastrous defeat under an emperor called Valerian, again by the Persians. It's great to have the Persians suddenly popping up in a bonus episode. He had been captured and subjected, it is tradition says, according to various humiliations. So he was supposed to have been used as a footstool by the Persian emperor. And when he died, his skin was taken off and dyed purple and stuffed with straw and used as a trophy in the Persian king's palace. And so it looks as though the whole of the eastern half of the Roman Empire is going to slip away. The Persians get defeated by the king of Palmyra, who is succeeded by his wife and queen called Zenobia, who basically is marketing herself as the new Cleopatra. But she gets defeated by Aurelian, takes her captive. She's led unlike Cleopatra, she gets taken to Rome and led in triumph. And Aurelian then embarks on the process of stitching back all the other parts of the empire that have fallen to pieces, which is actually pretty much what Constantine will do in the beginning of the 4th century. And like Constantine, Aurelian kind of, I don't think overtly, but inchoately, subconsciously recognizes that there is a need for a single deity that can provide a focus for loyalty for this very disunited empire. And so the god that he worshipped is Sol Invictus, the unconquered sun, and he tries to promote it, but he's not around for long enough really to enable it to put its roots down. And I don't think it would have greatly impaired the rise of Christianity, because I think Christianity succeeds for reasons that are much profounder than simply the need of a Roman emperor to have a single coherent focus of worship. Very important though that is. And that's why so Constantine contemplates enshrining Sol Invictus as a supreme god. You know, he auditions various gods for the role, but he ends up, I think, choosing Christ either because he genuinely comes to believe in Christ in a way that he doesn't in the other gods. But then the question is, why does Constantine end up believing in Christ? And I think it's because there is a greater emotional, intellectual heft to Christianity, and that is what is enabling it to put down much deeper roots than any of the other cults.
But there would be historians who might disagree with you about that, Tom.
Yeah, there would be, but I think they're wrong.
Yeah, but I'm just going to say there would be historians who say the imperial patronage is crucial.
For the rise of Christianity?
Yeah.
No, because I think it has already put down such strong roots by the time that Constantine comes to adopt it, that he is buying it into something that is, you know, he's getting on the winning side.
Yeah.
Constantine needs the church just as the church doesn't really recognize that it needs Constantine.
Okay.
But we must do, again, I mean, I know that we're kind of chucking out things that we do. We really have to do Constantine.
We do. Okay, let's have slightly quicker answers maybe, because we've been very waffly. So Mary Kirk Alves, friend of the show, a question for any Marxist historians.
That's you, Dominic.
Yeah, but you can answer this. Would we have Marxism without Marx? If Marx were eliminated in some alternative universe, would Marxist philosophy have developed and become as influential anyway? And what would we call it?
Yes, we would.
Yeah, I agree. We would call it Saint-Simonism or, I don't know, Babeufism or something.
It's a kind of godless, industrially infused, economically infused form of Christianity. So it would inevitably have happened. That's my
God
answer.
Almighty, God almighty.
I would say it's obviously a product of 19th century industrial society. There are lots of forerunners to Marx. If you read, I don't know, Edmund Wilson's book, To the Finland Station, that's a really wonderfully written book about the sort of intellectual origins of Marxism. And Marx himself, by the way, was an extraordinarily formidable intellect and a writer and a tremendously important figure. So maybe, you know, there wouldn't have been anybody with the same degree of intellectual sheer power that Marx had. But that idea, you know, the sort of, and as you say, actually, Tom, I was being hard on you, the utopianism.
Well, because Engels is doing it as well, isn't he?
Yeah. The millenarian sense, the sense of a scientific religion almost, appealing to the have-nots in the machine age, that undoubtedly would still have prospered, I would say.
Okay, here's a follow-up to the ones we did on 1960s fashion from Howard.
Yeah.
How much, if any, effect do you think Elvis joining the army and making the bubblegum movies had in opening a door for English bands to take over as the icons of rebellious youth? Did the Americans only take it back when their musicians went anti-establishment in Vietnam War?
Degree of truth in that, I think, Howard, actually. I think it's when the British groups arrive in 1964, it's generally agreed by sort of historians of pop culture and kind of rock music and so on, that rock and roll had lost its
soul.
Yeah, had lost its novelty. It had become, you know, Elvis is, he's not exactly yesterday's man, but he's approaching that status. And actually in the early 1960s, at the point at which British beat music really is getting off the ground, so 1962, 1963, if you look at the charts on both sides of the Atlantic, they're full of a lot of kind of strange cul-de-sacs and novelty records and things like that. So the popularity of kind of the Hawaiian type stuff or trad jazz in Britain, instrumental music, kind of. So in other words, the rock and roll of the sort of late 1950s is definitely no longer the cutting edge in 1962, 1963.
Elvis going into the army, that's just a symbol of that. It's not a cause.
It's a symbol of that rather than a cause, because of course Elvis would still have been, when's Elvis's heyday? 56, 57, 50, you know, probably late 50s. By 1963, when the Beatles come along, you know, the people who bought Elvis's records and loved Elvis when they were 16, they're now in their early 20s, aren't they? So we forget the sort of generational turnover that's implicit in this story, I would say. So yes, I think Elvis's joining the army and Elvis kind of going into the movies, and Elvis becoming sort of more mainstream and less cutting edge musical, I think that's a symbol of a bigger story.
Is it important to the global success of American music in the late 60s that it is anti-establishment?
To an extent, but I think it's probably fairer to say that the Americans were always going to recapture the musical initiative just because...
Weight of numbers.
Yeah, weight of numbers, kind of cultural, weight of cultural capital, I suppose, that the British were never, you know, the interesting thing is that the British didn't then go away. You might think that British thing would just be a blip. And then I think the Americans were always going to recapture the initiative, but the interesting thing is that British artists continued. And again, in the mid-1980s, when MTV came along, the second British invasion, in some ways an even more remarkable kind of chart triumph than the first British invasion. So that to me is more remarkable. The Americans have always been the powerhouse, I would say.
Okay, well, brilliant. We will thank you very much for listening, and we will be back next week with the origins of Harry Potter, the real Harry Potter, the real Hogwarts, and we will see you then. So bye-bye.
Bye-bye.